Good morning, everyone, and welcome. You are tuned in to The Vitamin Shelf, the only health talk program anywhere dedicated to eradicating the devastating condition known as nutrophobia. Let me explain. Everyone wants to be healthy. Too many of us believe that drugs play some role in this noble pursuit. But here's a question that truly needs to be answered. Can any of you listening name me one drug that makes you healthy? Exactly my point. So if you want to be healthy, you need to tune out the medicine chest and tune in to the Vitamin Shelf. Welcome, everyone. This online edition of the Vitamin Shelf, I am your host, Dave Stouter, owner of Apple Health Foods in Redwood City, California. And typically, because our store specializes in dietary supplements, that's what we usually talk about. But on the other hand, the whole thing about how we eat and what we eat and all that, as I said, you know, we vote with our feet. I talk, for instance, about the supplement industry. If we go and spend a lot of money on cheap, low-quality supplements, well, we're voting for those things. We're going to get more of them. When we say, hey, we want to buy high-quality supplements, we get more of them. That's why you are finding some of the better brands creeping into the mass market, because the mass market knows that's what a lot of people want. So in the same sense, what we buy, what we eat, is what we support. Now, many of us have been told, I remember the book, it wasn't Diet for a Small Planet by Francis Morlap, but the name escapes me. John Robbins, the Baskin-Robbins heir, had a pretty popular book at the time. I read it, and it was very convincing. I mean, it was very obvious from what he had in this book that being a vegetarian or a vegan was the way that we could eat that would sustain the planet, that our animal-based diet was destroying the planet, and that not only did we need to be vegetarians for our health, but we needed to sustain the planet. With us today is our second part interview with Liare Keith, and she's written a book that I came across, and I read it. I couldn't put it down. I was really impressed with the book, and it's called The Vegetarian Myth. And if you didn't hear the first part, I urge you just to flip back a page or two on the website and listen to it. But this is part two of my interview with Liare Keith, author of The Vegetarian Myth. Before we go any further, let's have our disclaimer so that none of you are inadvertently harmed by the information on this program. This is a public service announcement from your good friends at the FDA, the Fraud and Drug Administration. Many people assume that radio programs such as the Vitamin Shelf are safe and effective. Careful scientific analysis compels us to issue the following precautions, as many regular listeners have developed delusional behavior, such as people start behaving as if you can be healthy without medication, as if doctors are not deities, as if drugs cause disease rather than being cures, as if nutrition is healthy and drugs are dangerous. If you exhibit any of these delusions, please call your doctor right away and demand more medication. Welcome, everyone, to this online edition of the Vitamin Shelf. Thanks for tuning in today. I hope you heard several days ago I posted an interview with our guest today, Liare Keith, and she is the author of The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability. And if you would like to read a book that very powerfully shows why we should still be eating a hunter-gatherer diet, you might call it a paleo diet, but she explains it, and why that is so critical for our health, why the sort of agricultural diet that we've been on, especially in the last 100 years, is really at the root of all the health problems we face. And so I urge you to go back and listen to that, because and I urge you to read her book. Now, Liare, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Right. And in the last interview, I pointed out that in your book, you said as a young person, I think at 16, you were really struck by, we were at an emergency point. We had to change, and you weren't going to wait for everybody else. So you wanted to be healthy.
you wanted a sustainable planet, and you didn't want to kill to eat. And those were sort of the three things that drove you. Now, you told us last time how being a very devout vegan for 20 years completely ruined your health. And when you realized the way that humans were supposed to eat, most of that turned around for you. But I want to talk about this sustainability of the planet. We keep seeing images of we think the planet is being despoiled by our perchance to wanting to kill animals and eat animals and raise cows. And if we just went to this pastoral, nice agricultural world, we could grow all the crops and feed everybody, and it would just be a wonderful planet. So if everybody was vegetarian and vegan, we would save the planet. So so what do you say to that?
Okay, so the problem is that none of us actually live on farms anymore. None of us are from Nebraska or Iowa. We don't really know where our food comes from, and we don't know the price that we pay for that food ultimately as a planet. We've been doing agriculture for 10,000 years, and at this point, we don't even know what the world should look like. I mean, that's how far removed we are from the actual biological world. So we have to understand what agriculture is. And this is a really deep and broad cultural ignorance. I don't blame any of us for not knowing this. I had to do a lot of research to figure this out myself, including a lot of hands-on experiments in my own backyard. But the truth of the matter is, agriculture is the most destructive thing that people have done to the planet. Because this is what it is. You take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant that land to human use. So it's biotic cleansing, because you take over an entire biotic community, an entire ecosystem. You wipe out all the life, and then you plant corn or wheat or soy or oats or whatever it is you're going to plant. All those plants and animals have nowhere to go. This is mass extinction on a planetary scale. And bit by bit, all the agriculturalists have taken all the land that they could. There's nothing left for the plants and animals who need a home, who need to live there. So that's problem number one, is the mass extinction that this creates. Problem number two is that it's drawdown. So you're drawing down, you know, species and water and all that stuff to do agriculture. But at the bottom line really is that you're drawing down the soil, because every time you clear that land of that perennial polyculture, so either trees, you know, forests or prairies, grasslands, all of that has to be cleared away. And every time you expose the soil, you destroy it. So bit by bit, agricultural societies use up their soil. And there's no way around that. It's inevitable. And this is why agricultural societies end up militarized. They always do, because it's based on drawdown. So this pattern of civilization is you've got a power center at the middle of it, and then it's surrounded by conquered colonies, and the power center extracts what it wants. So fish and trees and soil and water, all of that goes to the power center, usually just to support the army, and then the entire thing collapses somewhere between 800 and 2,000 years, literally until the soil gives out. That is the moment at which the civilization will always collapse. And you can go through history and around the globe, and it's the same pattern over and over, because it's an inherently destructive activity. At this point, go ahead.
Well, no, so I want to make sure that everybody understands what – I had to close my window there, sorry – understands what you just said. So in other words, if you're living in the woods and you have your little garden and your animals and it, you know, the little river goes by, so you're pretty happy and you don't have to encroach upon me. But I'm 20 miles away, and I start building a little community, and we start growing. We clear out, we grow a bunch of crops and corn and stuff, and so I can get 30, 50, 100, 400 people in this space. Well, pretty soon I run out of land, and your land looks pretty good to me. So the militaristic idea is, so I come to you and say, join our community and be part of it because we need your land. You're like, no, David, that's not what I want to do. So finally I just go, look, we're going to starve if we don't take over her farm. So then we take you over because we need those resources. If there were less of us and we were living in a similar fashion to you, we could all live together. And so what you're saying is, on a planet-wide basis, when we make these large populations of people and we feed them with agriculture, we use up the land, we destroy the land, we need more land, and almost by just survival imperative, we have to take it from somebody.
Exactly. So 98% of the old growth forests are gone, and 99% of the world's grasslands have been destroyed as well. We have skinned the planet alive in the service of those annual grains. So there is nothing life-affirming or peaceful about this process. I didn't know that at age 16. Nobody told me. I had to find it out for myself. And it's a harsh reality that we have to face. I don't think it's beyond repair. I mean, I think we could repair human cultures and repair the planet. But we have to face what the primary damage is here, and it starts with agriculture.
Now, I know, and I read your book, you and I would both agree that if we go to typically some of the places where they raise cows, and it's very inhumane and filthy, and they feed them antibiotics, that no one's supporting that. But, of course, that's not the hunter-gatherer model. That kind of – that's almost like big cow agriculture. Now, I wanted – I always hear this argument as well, say, but Lierre, you have to feed, you know, 18 pounds of corn protein to a cow to get, you know, 1 pound of meat protein. We could all just eat the corn and be healthier. How can you say that's sustainable? I thought you had a very good answer for that. You know, 18 pounds of grain would be better fed to humans than a cow.
Well, cows are not meant to eat grain. They're actually meant to eat grass. They're ruminants. So feeding them grain actually kills them because it's too acid. And that's why they only last a few months in those horrible feedlots. I mean, they actually spend the first year and a half or so out on the range, and we can talk about whether that's done well or done poorly, but regardless, grass is their native diet. And then when you put them in these horrible CAFOs, the horrible factory farming, they die. I mean, pretty much every animal that comes out of there is either sick or half dead because of the grain feeding. And the only reason that all that grain is fed to cows is because of the Green Revolution, which, starting in 1950, created a mountain of surplus corn. And that surplus drove the price of corn down below the cost of production, which is to say it was so cheap that it suddenly made economic sense to stuff cows with that corn. It makes them really fat really fast. That's the point. And then you could get them to market a lot quicker. And, you know, when profit is the bottom line, that seems that's going to be inevitable. But what drove that is actually the Green Revolution. What drove that is that scientists figured out how to take oil and gas and turn it into fertilizer for corn. So it's all based on fossil fuel. And yes, it's horribly inhumane and destructive in every imaginable way. I mean, I think that's something we can all agree to, that this has got to stop. So two points here. One is that that's not the native diet of cows. And if cows are allowed to actually be cows and eat what they want to eat, you have a planet that can be repaired. Because without the grasslands, life on Earth is over, as far as I can see. It's really our only chance is to repair the grasslands and sequester the carbon. So that's number one. And number two is that Iowa is not producing corn so that it can be fed to cows. Those poor farmers are essentially serfs to the six corporations that control the world food supply. And with the monopoly that those corporations have, again, they can drive the cost, you know, that they pay for that, the price that they pay for that corn is below the cost of what it takes for the farmer to produce it. So they can never make a profit, these poor farmers. And every year they're trying to produce more and more and more just so they can keep their heads above water. But every year there's more surplus, which means every year the price is driven even further. And we've got crazy farm policy in this country because then the federal government steps in and simply subsidizes those farmers so that they don't all go out of business. But that money goes directly into the pockets of those giant corporations, which only makes the problem worse. We used to have a totally different kind of farm policy in this country, and I'm not going to get into that. But if people are intrigued, you really need to read about this, like do the research and find out more, because it's not animal agriculture that's driving this problem. It's the Green Revolution, and it's the farm policy, and it's ultimately those six corporations that are in charge of food. But taking that, you know, feeding that corn to people instead of cows is not going to stop world hunger, because what happens with those surpluses, besides being fed to cows, they're dumped in poor countries overseas. And that's what they call it, agricultural dumping. And it drives those local farmers out of business because the American corporations can sell it for about half the price that it costs the local farmers to produce it. So that American grain is actually causing starvation the world over. And that's just the political economics of it. I know people are very tenderhearted and they think they're doing the right thing by suggesting that people be dependent on American grain, but it wrecks their local economies and drives people off their land and into urban squalor. So on every level, this is not a solution.
No, and this is what I learned from your book, and the book is A Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability by our guest, Lierre Keith. I'm going to take a short break here, Lierre, and when I come back, now you've painted a very grim but real picture of world agriculture. I want to I then want to talk about how these realities affected your own garden. I think your garden and your sort of lifestyle was a nice little microcosm about how you set off to be completely vegan, completely sustainable, completely without animals, and sort of how that shaped into a hunter-gatherer reality for you. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Health Warrior Dave Stouter, and I'm a huge supplement advocate, but more importantly, I'm a consumer advocate, which is what I had in mind when I created Apple Health Foods. You see, I take a tremendous amount of supplements, and I need them to be authentic and reliable and safe. At Apple Health Foods, we have a large selection of high-quality and hard-to-find dietary supplements and body care that yours truly handpicks to be on our shelf from the best companies in the world. We offer a 20% in-store discount to our senior citizens 60 years or better, our CAP members a $25 annual fee, but we offer that discount to anyone who orders on our website, www.applehealthfoods.net. Apple Health Foods can ship supplements anywhere in the country. There are very few places where you can get such a high degree of confidence and a great discount on supplements. Call 877-APPLE-HF, that's 877-277-5343, 877-277-5343. All right, welcome back, everyone. We are here with author Lierre Keith of The Vegetarian Myth. Now, she just painted a very interesting picture of the impact of agriculture on our planet. I want to bring it down to a more personal level, Lierre, reading your book. Certainly, you're I'm going to start by saying attempt at having a garden, a nice healthy garden, free of any kind of animal influence or animal products was your goal, you know, that you were going to have the sustainable, humane kind of garden. And I, as I said in our earlier interview, first of all, you pointed out that your garden had sort of weak and sickly vegetables because they didn't have bone meal, they didn't have manure, they didn't have blood, they didn't have all these things that you'd get in the natural environment that you didn't want them to have because they were animal-based. And then you had to somehow get rid of the slugs without killing them or causing them to be killed. But the pressure of that garden sort of led you into a hunter-gatherer lifestyle a little more. So sort of tell us a little bit about that journey.
Well, like you said, I did make a valiant effort, and it was immediately clear that my plants were not eating. I was not feeding them what they wanted to eat because they were too small and they didn't produce. And it was very obvious that they were, you know, malnutrition had taken over. I mean, I was in New England, and the soil is very thin and very rocky, and you know, it's basically a granite slab with a tiny bit of topsoil over it, and there just wasn't a lot to draw on. I mean, in a richer kind of environment, maybe in the Midwest where there's still some prairie soils, I might have been able to extend this for a generation, but in my case, it was over almost immediately. And I went to this, you know, I read up on what was organic. I wanted to be organic, of course. And you go to the store and you try to buy the organic products that might feed your plants, and you read the ingredients and what's in it. Well, it's blood meal and bone meal. You know, it's slaughterhouse waste, essentially. And this was horrifying to my peaceful vegan soul. And the reality was before my eyes. I could see what my plants needed to eat, and it was unbearable to have to feed them those things. So, your other options are, of course, synthetic. You can get nitrogen from oil and gas, and then you can get various rock phosphates, ground-up rock products to try to add the minerals that the plants need. But, you know, I'm fooling myself at this point to think that there's no fossil fuel involved in grinding up rocks and transporting them halfway around the world. So I could see that that wasn't sustainable. Even if I could pretend it was vegan, it wasn't going to be sustainable. So you start making compromises because your ideology is not matching reality. And that was what I came up against over and over trying to do this, was that in every single action, there were animals involved. You know, whether I was willing to look at it or not, the plants needed the animals, the soil needed the animals. And eventually I just had to admit that that's what soil is. It's dead animals and dead plants worked upon by little microscopic bacteria and, you know, other microfauna who recirculate the nutrients and make them available again. And everybody is feeding somebody. But that was a very, very hard thing to face as a vegan. So, you know, I made compromises like, well, I have friends who have goats. The goats look happy. They've got a, you know, barn full of manure, and they'll let me have some. So I'll go get the manure. I'm not keeping the goats. So I'm not the big, evil, mean, oppressive person who has these domesticated animals, but I'll just take the manure. Well, that's silly. Somebody has to keep the goats if I'm going to get the manure. So it's not really a line that holds for very long. And then you have the problem with the insects. I mean, they're, you know, all kinds of infestations. I wasn't willing to spray terrible chemicals. And then the slugs took over. And what do you do with the slugs? I mean, it was awful. So I would go out in the middle of the night. Like you said, I would collect them. I didn't want to kill them. What do you do with them? So I went down the street and I let them go in a forested area. But it was, again, this terrible realization, because I sat there and I watched them for a minute and it just started to dawn on me. Why do I think that these slugs want to live here? Like, there's already slugs here. The slugs have probably reproduced. They filled that ecological niche. It's not like it's this endless wilderness in which there are no slugs. There are slugs here and they are already eating the detritus of the forest. There's not room for 30 more slugs here. They'd already be here if there was. They want my garden because that's good stuff to eat. They got nowhere else to go. So they're going to die of starvation if I leave them here. It was quite apparent. They'll either die themselves or they'll push out the other slugs that are already here. It doesn't work. You know, it's like every niche is filled in a healthy forest. So I had to admit that as well. It's like, I can pretend I'm not killing these slugs, but at the end of the day, I am killing these slugs. And the quicker way to do it was just to get ducks. So I got ducks and chickens, and then I was the evil person who had the domesticated animals, which was the thing I was determined to avoid. But it was amazing because there was not a single – I mean, that was it. Boy, those animals are so good at cleaning up a garden. There was no problem at all, no earwigs, no slugs, just none of those infestations. It was all gone. And they did a beautiful job, and they gave me great manure. So it helped close that loop, a whole other sort of turn on the cycle – when I admitted that, in fact, I needed the animals, that there is no nature without animals. And this attempt to take them out of the system meant that it was headed for collapse. So on the microcosm, yes, it was exactly what's happened on the macro.
Well, I also found it interesting that you had a little revelation. I think you were talking about getting some warm water for your chickens, and you were out freezing, annoyed and freezing and had cold water dripping down the back of your neck to take care of your chickens, who were nice and warm and cozy and very happy in their little cage. And you suddenly realize who was domesticating who. They were getting you to haul water for them and be miserable while they were very comfortable, and where you were supposed to be the oppressor who was domesticating chickens. And I thought that was very interesting that you wondered who was domesticating who.
Well, that's a point that I got from Michael Pollan's book, The Botany of Desire, because, you know, we think we've done this incredibly clever, amazing thing by domesticating plants and animals. And that's exactly his point. It's like, look, these plants got us to do their work for them. We've carried them all over the world. We've protected their babies. We've made them bigger and better by breeding them. But it's because they wanted us to do that. You know, they hooked into some pleasure center in our brains, something that moved us or compelled us, and for the sake of those plants, we've done extraordinary things. So he talks about apples. He talks about marijuana. He talks about potatoes. What was the fourth one? I don't remember. It's a fabulous book, and it's the same thing with the animals. Like, those chickens were happy as clams in their beautiful house. They had everything they could need. I was the one who was the slave. They had fabulous lives, and humans have carried chickens all around the globe. I mean, when you think about the jungle fowl progenitor sitting on her little tiny nest of eggs in the rainforest in Southeast Asia, in her wildest dreams, she could not have gotten to North America, you know, but hooked to humans. Yes, we've carried them all over the world. Same with pigs, same with dogs, all of it. So these are not necessarily relationships that are about exploitation. They're mutual. You know, there's an intermingling, an interdependence between us and these plants and animals, where we join our forces and extraordinary things have been possible. Not necessarily good things, but absolutely extraordinary things.
Well, yeah, you point out that the relationships are reciprocal and not one-sided, as we're led to believe. So in closing, it was interesting. I was talking to a woman just yesterday, came in with her husband, and she was facing some health issues and asking for my advice. And she, as I was recommending some supplements, she did tell me that she was a vegan, you know, and I should take that into account, which supplements I might recommend. And but she was having some health problems that made me think of your book. And I sort of, you know, told her, I said, you know, it's interesting you bring that up. And I started talking about your book, The Vegetarian Myth, and I began talking about your story. But when it came down to, she just said, I'm not going to kill to eat. That's what she said to me. She just like, okay, that's my line in the sand. And what I would like to do, Lierre, is have you back because you've made a very good and of course you do it even better in your book, but you make a great case for the agricultural diet is not healthy for us. You've made a great case for the agricultural diet is not healthy for the planet. But we're really preached and we get this, but we don't want to kill things. It's so mean to kill things. It's so, you know, we're oppressing. We're just killing animals for our own gratification. It's a terrible thing. And as a devout vegan, that drove you. In fact, I would wager that not wanting to cross that line is what kept you being sick for so long, saying, I'm sick, this isn't working, but I know it's right because I don't want to kill. So I'd like to have you back, and let's address that issue. What about the killing of animals? Is that humane? Is that a good thing? Shouldn't we avoid it? Will you do that for us?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, good. I'm looking forward to that. This is we're talking to Lierre Keith. I really urge you to get her book, The Vegetarian Myth. We're going to take a short break. Don't go away. This is Health Warrior Dave Stouter, and I'm a huge supplement advocate, but more importantly, I'm a consumer advocate, which is what I had in mind when I created Apple Health Foods. You see, I take a tremendous amount of supplements, and I need them to be authentic and reliable and safe. At Apple Health Foods, we have a large selection of high-quality and hard-to-find dietary supplements and body care that yours truly handpicks to be on our shelf from the best companies in the world. We offer a 20% in-store discount to our senior citizens 60 years or better, our CAP members, a $25 annual fee, but we offer that discount to anyone who orders on our website, www.applehealthfoods.net. Apple Health Foods can ship supplements anywhere in the country. There are very few places where you can get such a high degree of confidence and a great discount on supplements. Call 877-APPLE-HF, that's 877-277-5343, 877-277-5343.
So I'll tell you something, everyone, as you probably have gathered from listening to the conversation, I found Lierre Keith's book absolutely fascinating, and we have been able to cover some of the points and I think give you a taste, if you will, of the kind of information that she presents. But her book was quite comprehensive, having a lot of information about food and nutrition and the planet and the way economies work and all kinds of things, which I really think people should consider because I think she makes a very, very good case that we've been misled, either by just people making assumptions and not really doing their homework. And my mission has always been to really help people get the right information so they could be healthy. My forte is dietary supplements, which is why Apple Health Foods is a supplement store and why most of the information that we talk about here is oriented around supplements because I do think supplements are important, and that's sort of what I think I can provide. But at the same time, food is the primary source of nutrients and should be. And so eating the right kind of food, not only for your own health and the sustainability of the planet, is pretty critically important. And I believe this book, The Vegetarian Myth, is just, it'll transform many of you. I really hope that you'll take the time to read it. I mean that. I think if you read this book, it will not fail to enlighten you. There's some, Lierre is a great writer. There's a little bit of humor. The book is quite interesting. And it'll probably really challenge a lot of your preconceptions about things. But I really think that nobody can get from the beginning to the end of this book and not get some good information that will contribute to their overall health. So it's not just, I like the book, gee, I think you will too, you ought to read it. I really don't see how anybody can read this book and not come away with information that will improve their health. Now, again, the book is called The Vegetarian Myth, and our guest has been Lierre, L-I-E-R-R-E, as she says, like Pierre with an L, Keith, K-I-E-T-H. I got it on my Kindle, as I get a lot of books now, e-books. It's in the library. We checked around here. It's in the public library, both their e-book library and their physical book library. Now, obviously, you can get your bookstores and on Amazon and all the websites, Barnes & Noble. I'm not trying to leave anybody out. But however you get this book, I would urge you all not to let your interest that I'm sure you have after listening to this pass over. Even if you think, if you hear what we've been discussing and you say, that doesn't sound right. That's not what I've heard. I read this other book. I challenge you to read the entire book. Don't just go by the little bit of information we were able to cover here on the show. I hope you will read the book, The Vegetarian Myth, and put your thinking caps on. All right, until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and thanks for listening.